Blog Talk Radio.
Doing well today. It's the weather's getting really nice out here in Northern California, and I love a good barbecue. I've always loved them as a kid, you know, barbecuing hot dogs and hamburgers and stuff like that. But you know, the older you get, the more sophisticated you get. And I'm going over to a friend's house today, and this guy, man, he's got a smoker and he's got a barbecue, and he does something that just is amazing. He does these jalapeno bacon wrap barbecue, smoked barbecue treats, I guess you call them. And you know, and then he puts a little goat cheese in those things too. And man, are they good. And it's kind of like a prelude to the tri-tip he cooks. And the guy, you know, I don't know, I just don't have the bandwidth to do that. But I mean, he does ribs and he does tri-tip and he does pork. He does pulled pork. He does these little, I think he calls them little bombers, where he, like I said, he takes a jalapeno and wraps with bacon. And those things are amazing. So, hey, kicking off the barbecue season, that's kind of an American pastime, to get out in the summertime, fire up the barbecue, or the new thing now. And it's probably not a new thing. I just, you know, if you go to the South, if you go to other parts of the country, smokers are a big deal. And he's got a smoker that has an automatic chip feed, this little pellet feed, wood pellet feed that gets put into the barbecue. And he's got like three different thermostats that are going at the same time, and he's got them plugged in, one plugged into the tri-tip. He sent me a picture just a little while ago, that's why I know this. He's got one plugged into the tri-tip, one plugged into the pork, and another one just for the general temperature. And this is a smoker. So hey, and it tastes great too. So hey, hope you can get out and do some barbecuing if you're into that. And if you're not a meat eater, you know, I've had barbecued zucchini, and I've had barbecued carrots, and I've had, a meatless barbecue. And I went through a non-meat period, which is about 3 months. Couldn't do it, actually. But, yeah, barbecue is for everything, you know, vegetables. It's great. So barbecue time, yeah. I hope you've had a chance to check out the Facebook page. And I posted a really interesting follow-up to our interview with Carmen Balter, Dr. Carmen Balter, the giant underground labyrinth that they have found again in Egypt. It was described by Herodotus. Can't even talk this morning, during the Roman times. Herodotus spoke about it a number of times in his writings, and described it as a massive underground complex. And Klaus Dana using some new technology. This is about a year ago. Scanned the area and actually found it. And working with Carmen Balter, revealed these images in a number of publications and on my show. And I have posted a new video that describes this labyrinth and shows there's some more research that's being done there. This is about a year old, and I don't think that anything new has happened over there because there's a lot of red tape to do any kind of digging in Egypt. And it might be, you know, another year away before we actually get somebody down to one of these tunnels to see actually the depth of them. But we do know that they are, there's multiple chambers that go down, you know, over 100 feet. And that's something to consider. So go to the Earth Ancients Facebook page and go to, you'll scroll down, you'll see it. The Underground Labyrinth Revealed is the article. So check that out. Our friends Dave and Rob from Roads to Ruins have a new episode, episode 7. I've put that on the Facebook page too. It's called Ancient Hopi Prophecy, and they describe a lot of these petroglyphs that they find in Arizona, and I think they also go to New Mexico. You can see that video on the Facebook page, and I'm fascinated with what they're doing. They're financing these episodes, these video presentations on their own, and each of them is really a little jewel. I also have a link to the full page, and it's all free. It's all free. You just click on the link. You can see episodes 1 through 7, and they're basically showing an ancient past to America. And they're the only ones I know of who are on this constantly. They're on the road every month. They have a new episode. So check it out. Roads to Ruins, and their travels are very, very interesting. The last thing I want to mention is that I put up a new gallery on Baalbek, Lebanon, and the Baalbek ruin. I was sent a series of photos from the main complex there and the Temple of Jupiter. And the Temple of Jupiter is unique because the stonework around the temple, the base stonework, are megaliths, you know, several tons. One or two pieces are in the 50 to 60 ton range. And this image, or these images of this gallery I have up on the Facebook page, reveals the actual machining of corner pieces and some of the details around the cutting of the stone. Now, up until this gallery came, and I haven't been there, so I haven't seen it up front. I've seen most of the photographs that people have posted. And, of course, Graham Hancock features Baalbek fairly prominently in his new book, Magicians of the Gods. And there's a number of other people that have posted images in their books. But this gallery is quite unique because the photographer shows not only the size of these stones, but somehow they were machined. Some kind of a tool cut into these stones. And when you see this one corner stone, it's cut with such a level of precision, you would think that you're looking at something from the Washington Monument or stonework that you would find in a current building. It's that clean and it's that perfectly cut. And it really makes you question how in the heck they did it. There's just no way they could have used chisels or some copper tools or whatever. It's done with some kind of machining. And you can see because of the crisp edges, the accuracy of the cut and the beautiful stonework. It's a really beautifully finished piece. So check it out. Earth Ancients Facebook, and scroll down and you'll see a new gallery of Baalbek, Lebanon. It's one of my favorite places. I got to get out there. That's one of my bucket list places to check out. It's an amazing place. So, hey, if you're in the Bay Area, on September the 15th through the 18th in Berkeley, there is a new conference called the New Paradigm Shift Conference. And people like Dr. Sam Osmanovich is going to be there, Michael Tillinger. I didn't even think Brian Forrester is going to make a trip. And there's like 40 different speakers. It's a small new program, the New Paradigm Shift, and the prices are really reasonable. If you want to learn more about it, check it out. It's www.5devents, the number 5, capital D, events.com, 5devents.com. It's coming September 15th through the 18th in Berkeley, and wow, pretty good lineup. In fact, a major lineup, so I'll definitely be checking that out. So if you're in the Bay Area or you're going to be in the Bay Area, that's something to consider if you're looking to learn more about ancient Earth. And there's some good pyramid presenters like that. Dr. Sam, he'll be there. So on to pyramids. You know, I have talked about pyramids repeatedly. I'm fascinated by Mayan pyramids, Central Mesoamerican pyramids. We've had a number of people on the program. Robert Bival talked about the positioning of the Great Pyramid, how it connects with the Orion constellation. Chris Dunn spoke about the precision of the pyramid and also discussed his guess at the probable workings of it, some kind of a machine. And we've had other people less known describe their belief of how this pyramid, the Great Pyramid, was made, why the pyramid culture was important to us. And of course, my favorite topic, John Burke, the scientist who describes the electromagnetic properties underneath some of these pyramids and what the pyramids in his mind were used for. But my guest today has taken a look at the Great Pyramids and the pyramid culture and has come up with a fascinating idea for their use and what the ancients might have thought about the pyramids and why they created this entire culture. John Shaughnessy is a researcher and author. He was recently featured at the first Global Pyramid Conference, which was, in Chicago. And his take on these pyramids is quite unique. His book, Pyramid Gravity Force, is quite unique. I had a chance to look at it the other day, and he has numerous individual sketches in there and his belief of how the pyramid functions. And John, welcome to the program. It's really great to have you.
Thank you for having me, Cliff. Glad to be here, you know.
Yeah.
Really nice to get on your show.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I'm always interested in researchers who are doing work on pyramids or ancient structures like the pyramid complexes. I got to ask you, this book is fascinating. Was this something that you, looking at pyramids, were just like something trigger your thinking? What was like the trigger point, the point where you said, you know what, this is something that I got to check into. I got to know something more about this. There's something that was not being, discussed.
Yes, exactly. All of that, and then some. It's always been a fascination to me, the paranormal, the unexplained around the globe. And, I got touched by Eric Von Doniggen there and Chariots of the Gods when I was younger. And, and you know, a few other authors back in the day there, and you know, I always was fascinated with you know, something that wasn't explained, you know, well, or, you know, or the explanation just didn't ring true. So, you know, I've always been you know, into you know, the pyramids and, you know, ancient you know, technologies or ancient societies, and you know, and you know, I kept up on it, kept reading over it over the years, like 30 years basically of, you know, getting into all sorts of disciplines and sciences. And you know, it's funny, like years later you wonder why you were interested in a particular subject. Like, you know, I read Einstein's theory of relativity on my own, you know, and a few other books of that magnitude. But, you know, I got the gist of it. But you know, it's just one of those things I was very interested in. Always was interested in gravity, the force of gravity, and you know, what the latest theories were. And
right.
So one day, you know, I go walking into the living room, and somebody left the TV on, and I'm just about, you know, I'm doing a free fall into the lazy chair, and Makio Aku was on, and the last word before he broke for a commercial was he basically said, "We still don't know what these pyramids are for."
Mm-hmm.
So as I was sinking into the cushions there, I looked over at my floor mount globe. I've always had globes around. You know, I was fascinated with geology and things of that nature. So I had a globe in the corner of the living room, and I just a you know, little thought, you know, the epiphany, the light went on. I was, geez, I wonder what's on the other side of Giza, latitude wise. And so I'm looking at the globe. The globe's looking at me. You know, and I'm like, okay, up we go. So I took the long hall across the living room, 15 feet or so, and you know, I spun the globe from Giza to, you know, 180 degrees on the same latitude, and there was a Hawaiian hotspot, you know, the Hawaiian Islands. I said, oh, geez, that's amazing, you know. And then from there, it just grew. I just started to you know, get into other pyramids all over the globe, and the large pyramid complexes all had alignments with volcanoes, 180 degrees opposed to each other and on the same latitude. So basically latitude is like, you know, the ladder, you know, your step ladder, you go up, do a little painting on the wall in the house or something like that. It's the easiest way to remember it. And then they have, you know, the earth is basically, you know, there's a stratification lines on the globe or a map, and those are latitudes. So if you just, you know, on the right side of the ladder, you had a pyramid, and on the left side you'd have a volcano, and if you're looking down, you know, from the pole, it was 180 degrees opposed to each other. So if you stuck a yarn pin straight through, you'd come out. So, you know, I lined up Giza with Hawaii. I lined up I made the connection between the Pyramid of the Sun complex with Sri Lanka, and the Shen pyramids in China lined up with the Bermuda super caldera islands. I mean, that's the island there is made up of two ancient extinct super calderas. So, you know, it just went on and on and on and on. So I said, what is all this about? I mean, what's going on here? Like, what were they doing? You know, and it's a very sophisticated ancient society, and what it's all, you know, been basically pointing to lately was magma control. You know, plate tectonic control. They were, you know, they're a type three society. We're not even a type one society yet, and a type three society basically controls its environment. So the way you control
that's
environment,
that's the scientist's theory of the three or the whatever four phases of civilization. Yeah,
the Kardashev scale. Right.
Yeah. So basically, you felt that, and you feel that actually that these pyramids were aligned with active and inactive volcanoes, and some. So you actually called the pyramids geoengineering devices, and
right.
I find that quite unique. What? Tell us how. I mean, because they must have been brilliant to do something like this, to really know the Earth itself, its gravitational fields, and how these tectonic plates connect, and then the forces of nature producing volcanoes. So is
right.
it your belief that like the Great Pyramid itself is it some kind of a machine, or is it just there to balance the gravitational fields?
It's like Chris Dunn said, you know, he'll get on in history as labeling it as machine. It's built like a machine. It looks like a machine. It's a machine, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my science has led me into, very, very theoretical physics, deep theoretical physics, and basically their lenses, gravitational lenses. All these pyramids around the globe, they condense gravitational wave, the live gravitational wave from the moon. So the moon, you know, you see the moon in action every day. I mean, it's moving trillions of tons of ocean water. It also it also strokes the magma currents below, and it's got a self-balancing mechanism to it. So you know, getting back to your question there, these machines, we can get into the physics a little later, but I mean, get to these machines. There's two types of volcanoes out there. The artificial type is a constant erupting volcano that is created by the islands, the pyramids in the Nile Valley that play off of a mountain in the Sudan. So it's like a combination of a mountain and then a string of pyramids that basically lends the gravitational field on that side of the planet. And then it manipulates and lowers the gravitational field on the other side of the planet. Now, you see this in action and evidence every day. It's observable evidence. When there's a high tide on the moon side of the planet, 180 degrees opposed to it on the same latitude, you have a moonless high tide. So, I mean, you see, you know, the evidence is stark. It's right in your face on how gravity works on a planet. And this is how gravity works on a planet with, structured mass like pyramids, geometrical mass like pyramids and volcanoes. To have a large mass, like some of these pyramids are enormous. The Great Pyramid of Giza, everybody's, you know, that's the most famous one. It's six million tons. There's pyramids down in Guatemala
mm-hmm.
that are twice the size of that, you know, and they tie into volcanoes in the Indian Ocean, near the Sumatra.
Can you describe one of the Guatemalan pyramids that you're referring to that's really big? Are you talking about something in Tikal or somewhere else?
It's La Dante and the El Tigre pyramids.
Oh, La Dante. Yeah, that is a big one.
They're 1,000 feet high. They're completely consumed by the jungle.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, but they're they basically line up with volcanoes in the Sumatra subduction zone. So there's like pyramids were built to keep a subduction zone soft and malleable and flexible. Keeping the hot current, keeping the hot magma current. These pyramids set up magma currents, hot spots, if you will, under tectonic plates, and they keep it soft. So every 24 hours, you get a flex from the moon, okay? So, and then, you know, the moon's gravitational pull flexes tectonic plates every rotation that we do. Every day, every joint boundary, tectonic plate boundary gets flexed by the moon. So if you put pyramids in certain locations, you can, soften up the plates and reduce the amount of energy being built up at these places and prevent, you know, tidal waves, massive earthquakes, and tsunamis and other, horrific natural events. So
yeah.
Getting back to volcanoes, there's two types of volcanoes. There are the man-made ones or the pyramid-made ones. There's a constant eruption volcano, and all your other volcanoes are just natural volcanoes. They basically build up pressure, blast off, you know, wipe out everything for miles around, and they seal back up for, 100 or 20 years or 1,000 years or whatever. So if you're a sophisticated society, you're going to want to, leave a vent open. So that's what they've done out in the Pacific hotspot, the Pacific Ocean, the Hawaiian hotspot. So they've used these pyramids to create a constant erupting volcano. So if any pressure builds up, it just dribbles out. I mean, you know, the Kilauea volcano is just dribbling 24/7, 365, and it's the Hawaiian hotspot is created by the pyramids in Giza, and that basically prevents the buildup of pressure. So that's been open for, you know, quite a long time, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, who knows? But it's always like I always get the question, what came first, the pyramid or the volcano? But this society punched holes in three of the biggest tectonic plates. They punched a hole with pyramids in the Pacific plate. They punched a hole with pyramids in the Atlantic plate, and they punched a hole in the Indian Ocean plate with the Shen pyramids. So at one time, when these pyramids were all in their heyday, you know, and what I mean is they were, you know, built to the original specifications, like the pyramids in Giza. They had they were perfect. They had an outer casing. They were lenses basically, and they would focus the gravitational field from the moon to a tight focal point, and allow that hotspot to basically stay in existence. So if somebody came up to you and says, hey Cliff, how can we get all these volcanoes from quiet them down over in Malaysia, Indonesia, what you would tell them is, okay, we got to rebuild the Pyramid of the Sun complex, maybe enlarge it and open up that hotspot on Sri Lanka, you know, the island of Sri Lanka, and just allow magma that builds up in that part of the world just to dribble out. So that's a fascinating theory.
Yeah.
I mean, and like I said, there's observable evidence. All the alignments are undeniable. The way gravity works is undeniable. If you look at just the simple moon, you know, high tide type of effects.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the theory's kind of built, you know, it's like most people that discover things. You make one big discovery, then all of a sudden everything starts to become related. You know, it's all relative. Still a quote from Einstein, but I use his. But it all becomes relative after a while.
Yeah.
And then,
I have to ask you: is it your belief that this the culture that built the Great Pyramid shared that information with the Maya? Because the Maya have built some of the biggest pyramids, the most sophisticated pyramids in the Americas, and most people feel that the original builders of the Giza pyramid on the Giza plateau are much older than Khufu, the Pharaoh dynasty. That the pyramid itself might be like 10,000 years old or older. And then the Maya came on the scene. I believe they're older than what the current science believes. I think they're probably pre-flood, which would make them in the 9,000 plus years old. But is it your feeling that in your study that this is a kind of a universal theme that these pyramids were used to massage and create effect on the tectonic plates?
Getting back to the timeline, I'm glad I don't have tenure at a university. I can just say what I instinctively, intuitively feel. And you're going back millions of years with this technology. So it's I'm completely off the reservation when it comes to that. And
okay.
You can get into your religious texts, and there's a big chunk of human history just wiped off the pages. You know, I think that, and that's what we're doing now. I mean, this whole movement is trying to backfill a lot of the missing pieces. And you're up against some awful institutions that don't want to hear anything over 5 or 10,000 years.
It's funny you say millions of years, because the Bosnian pyramids, according to Dr. Sam Osmanovic, he believes that's a 50,000-year-old. Or older pyramid, which would be a whole another culture, completely unknown to us, and yet there's scientists that are measuring a beam that is coming out of this thing. It sounds like an engine of some kind. So you know, it's a possibility that this is a culture that has been handed down for millions of years, which would really be a mind blower to conventional science, because that wouldn't make sense to them.
Well, it makes more sense if you look at the age of these volcanoes and their movements of the plates, and a lot of them you can backfill, and get a pretty good indication of timelines. And again, these the technology on the planet is millions of years old, but the pyramids themselves need to be rebuilt.
Yeah.
Every couple of millennia, every cycle of the precession, or a couple of precessions,
yeah.
Of, once an ice age. An ice age generally is 100,000 years, then you get an interglacial, maybe in the interglacial periods you rebuild these pyramids just to get control over your magma currents and, keeping the tectonic plates quiet and malleable,
yeah.
And, really does, is more conducive for life on the planet. So there's more stability.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question. I don't know if you're familiar with, I'm sure you have an idea, but the recent discovery at Chichen Itza and the El Castillo pyramid shows that it was built over a cenote, which and also a river of running water. And I believe John Burke and his scanning technology scanned it and found that it was also under a geomagnetic field. And I guess the point I'm trying to make on that pyramid is not only those natural forces, water and geomagnetic fields coming up through the pyramid, but that current pyramid, which was a couple of thousand years old, was built over an older pyramid, actually built on top of an older pyramid that's significantly older. And I think it's also been scanned, and someone reported a couple of years ago that they can hear a buzzing noise.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is some kind of an engine or some kind of effect that's taking place there. I mean, it's your belief that these pyramids were used to adjust tectonic movements. Actually, how does that work? How would an ancient Mayan, and you're saying that they built this pyramid to adjust the Earth's tectonic plates so that someplace on the other side of the planet wasn't erupting, or it was in control of some kind. I mean,
leading off magma pressure, really. Yeah.
Okay. So I mean, they must have communicated, across great distances. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah, I don't buy into the current timeline. So the people that were, putting these pyramids together years ago, I believe, they were skipping through the solar system, if you will. And,
mm-hmm.
they had all the technology and then some that we have today to make the changes. Now, I've come to find that, there's three types of pyramids, and the larger ones are for magma control. Because they displace the gravitational field on the opposite side of the planet, like the moon does, and a good way to look at a pyramid is it's a magnifying glass. Your typical household magnifying glass, hold it up in the sun, and you adjust it to a tight focal point, and you basically create a high dense photon. Location at the focal point, you generate heat, kids would do it when they were younger, chasing ants around, or, burning your friend's arm, whatever you were doing. But, a life support system for, being out in the wild, you can light a fire with it. So that's the basics of a subatomic particle. Now, the photon, it's agreed, is a subatomic particle. The graviton, in theory, is a subatomic particle. So if you can condense one subatomic particle with a lens, you should be able to, do the same with the other subatomic particle. And then basically getting back, I didn't repeat myself, but, these pyramids are lenses. and they set up a tight gravitational field inside the pyramids. And you can hold a plumb bob up next to a pyramid, it doesn't hold plumb. It gets pulled towards the pyramid. That's a well-known fact. But getting into sizing pyramids, one is for magma control, you know, punch and hole through plates. Those are large pyramids, large pyramid complexes, to get control over volcanic activity around the globe, like those three places I mentioned before. And then medium-sized ones would be used for, medium to small size. You would use them for pulling up water. Local areas that, you know, you have groundwater. You would build pyramids to work off of the moon's gravitational field. And basically, you know, during a rainstorm, whatever, you have a lot of rain and this, that, and the other thing, filling up the aquifers. Well, what a pyramid does, in conjunction with the moon, it also has tidal forces, just like your oceans. It'll pull the groundwater up to that pyramid and basically keep the aquifers and the ground tables full, you know, in that localized area. Because, you know, water is the key to all life. You got to have fresh water. And then the other... those would be small pyramids. Sorry, they're getting out of line here. A medium-sized pyramid would be to use to raise the ground. If you look at all the pyramids around the world, most of them, if not all of them, are higher than the surrounding area. So, you know, the thought is, and this is my working on the gravitational fields there, is, you know, if that they are gravitational lenses, that if you build a pyramid on a bedrock or ledge or whatever, in unison with the moon's gravitational field, you will raise that land that the pyramid is sitting on. I mean, you'll pull groundwater up, but you'll also raise the land that pyramid's sitting on.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, you see some good evidence of all the pyramids in Central America. Central America is a very small strip of land. And there's like from Mexico to the northern tip of South America, there's close to over 300 pyramids in that little, you know, section of land. And that, I think that was used to shore up that strip of land in South America, the whole South America.
Wait a minute. So are you saying that there's an alignment of pyramids from Central to South America? You can like draw a line and they all kind of connect?
No, they're not. They're not. There's no real. I don't know of any real alignment. But
you're just saying that they're scattered.
All those countries.
They're scattered. Large,
yeah, there's a huge number of pyramids in that small section of landmass. So it was built to shore up the land, to raise that land. Now you got to go back to. You got to look at like the planet builders. I call these people the planet builders, the planet adjusters, the light beings, mm-hmm. God, whatever. And you want to have that strip of land between South America and North America in place, which is Central America, and that basically keeps the two largest conveyor belts, ocean conveyor currents, separate from each other. So if you had a washout on Central America, those two currents would get wiped out with the huge flow of water going from one to the other, and you would go into a immediate ice age, literally, because a lot of the globe is temperate because of the ocean currents. So the planet builders, the designers, the light beings, they had the pyramids built. They built the pyramids in that area to raise that landmass. And, you know, you got a little bit of, you got the land mass, you raise the land mass, you get fresh water, and also you every action has an equal and opposite reaction. You're displacing the gravitational field 180 degrees away from the pyramid, and you have a volcano, you know, or a soften up tectonic.
There's been more research on the pyramid technology. Recently, they found mercury at the pyramid of the Teotihuacan, the Plum Serpent pyramid. I don't think they've dug under the main sun pyramid, but a number of authors have said that the pyramids were energy generators. In fact, Chris Dunn distinctly describes a technology where there would be an internal combustion that would create a electrical or a geomagnetic kind of a output. Do you believe that that was the use for some of these pyramids, that other than aligning the tectonic plates and keeping these volcanoes in check, that they also had a secondary purpose, which would be generation of energy?
Well, you know, it's they're multidimensional devices. If you're condensing a gravitational field, you're going to be creating a magnetic field, you know. So you could essentially, you know, tap into the magnetic field that you're creating in conjunction with the moon's gravitational. The moon runs all the gravity on the planet. You know, it's like the sun has a little bit, but the moon is the big V8 engine under the hood. So you could, you know, conceivably, if you locate the focal point inside of a pyramid and, you know, put a bunch of wires in there, you know, some iron, you know, create a magnetic field, you could conceivably, you know, get electrons to flow through conductors and generate some power. I don't know what the output would be. I'd be honest with you, I don't know if it's that much, but I think it's just a residual anomaly from the condensing of the gravitational field inside these lenses, you know, pyramids. So I think, you know, I'm not going to, you know, that's just my feeling. That's just my feeling. I'm not going to poo-poo anybody else's theories. We're all in the ranks here, trying to push forward, and you know, it's best that we all get along and, you know, keep pushing this these ideas and theories out.
Right.
I think at the end of the day, it's, you know, humanity and all the life forms on the planet will benefit from it. You know.
You make a good point.
As far as Mercury, Mercury is in those. One in China and it was another, the one you mentioned in Mexico, and I think Spain. Well, Spain, Mexico, China, and there's one other place have the highest concentration of mercury in their soil in different parts of their countries. So, and this proves my theory also, because mercury is a liquid. So, and it might be able to even get a timeline if we can, measure the migration of the concentration of mercury where it does pool up under a pyramid, you know, and that's exactly what it does. If you build a pyramid over, you know, in an area where the concentration of mercury in the soil is high, over time that mercury is going to migrate towards the pyramid because it's a higher gravitational field. So it's going to pull everything that's liquid towards it. So, that's my thoughts on that. But like I said, it's all relative. You know, it moves liquid. You know, you create a dense, high gravitational field someplace. It's going to pull things towards it. Well, generally, it doesn't pull, a lot of solid mass, but it will pull liquid, you know, because it flows through the grade, just like water. If they're big enough, they affect the gravitational field on the other side of the planet. Gravity has a balancing mechanism. I reject the theory of Pangea. You know, I toss those books out in a heartbeat. The idea that, you know, you have the whole all the land mass of the planet on one side is absolutely mad, because the planet would just rip itself apart. Everything in the universe is balanced. All the planets, moons, solar systems, you get galaxies, you name it. Everything is set up because gravity has a self-balancing mechanism. And, you know, you have a land mass on one side of the planet, you're going to lower the gravitational field on the other side of the planet and allow magma or plates to heave or mountains to grow up and balance off the planet. You know, right now the Earth is in what I call as a three-phase signature. So it's putting out a three-phase gravitational signature from the angular momentum of the rotational velocity of the Earth. So, I mean, the Earth is doing 1,100 some odd miles an hour. But if you were outside the Earth and you had the instrumentation and know-how, you would be able to measure the ocean would be like a neutral signature, and the landmass would be have a higher gravitational signature. So that is actually deflecting space time, going way out past the moon. Who knows? Maybe into the other planets and vice versa, coming back towards us.
Mm-hmm.
So these are all my these are all my, you know, I got a lot of papers. I got to get busy into publishing. I usually just come up with stuff, copyright it, and then I move on to something else. But I have there's a lot of things going on out there that, takes time. It takes time for
sure
theories out there and migrate and the evidence. But a lot of this is supportable evidence and. It's growing anyways. It used to be picking
Let's
up
Let's talk
speed.
A little bit about the actual pyramids themselves. In your book, you describe explorations of an Arab king, Caliph al-Ma'mun. And I guess it's 820 A.D. He and his men bore into the Great Pyramid. Yeah. Can you and you actually describe what you think was an because he may have damaged this machine, you believe that he may have caused a problem on the tectonic plates. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, lenses. The pyramids are gravitational lenses. If you burrow a hole in it, you're basically lowering bypassing it or lowering the gravitational, field inside the center line. These things are set up to, basically create a tight focal point in the center line of the pyramid. If you cut a hole on the outside of the pyramid, tunnel into it, you're allowing the gravity wave to basically be pulled in from the passageways that you create or the tunnels or vice versa. So, there's some evidence also. Like he went in 833, he broke in there, and it's just amazing, obviously you stand in front of these things and they're not, they're made by the gods, a sophisticated machine, but they were looking for the big stash. It sounds like, well, there's not much to really go on. There's a little bit of small papers, a couple of pages, if that, of evidence and of the story. But what has been handed down was, he broke into it, and then I guess he didn't really get much anything out of it. They were there probably for a long time getting through that casing, and they actually went in. It went in above the entrance or below the entrance. I forget. I think it was below the entrance, the true entrance. So they must have had some knowledge of where the entrance was, but they came in below it. But long story short, he leaves, and then not too much later, maybe a few months later, before the year out, there was a massive earthquake in Cairo, in Egypt. And a lot of the casing stones were reportedly had fallen off of the pyramids, and that's the lensing ability of that's the the real tight they're operating. They built these things at optician's level of optics, the level of an optician. So I mean, there's some evidence there. And then you had Colonel Weiss went in the 1830s. He was in there blasting away, he blasted, chambers up through the relieving chambers or tunnels. And again, he left, and they had a massive earthquake over in Egypt also. So, it's evidence, you can say, well, it could have happened, anyways, but it just seems to, tie into this, this destructive penetration into the world's pyramids. They're actually, if you look at the gravity as a theory, and it's a field, it's a displacement on mass, and you burrow a hole in it and it's going to pull in the gravity wave, or it might actually flex the focal point out of position inside the pyramid, so it's basically been damaged. So so when you do get into warmer periods on the earth, these pyramids are supposed to be closed up and kept in good good shape, and they'll puncture, you know, they'll keep those constant erupting volcanoes going, and you won't have the earthquakes and the, you know, the total destruction that you're getting today.
Yeah.
So,
is there any way to measure these gravitational waves? Is there a piece of equipment that you could use to measure what these effects are? Because I think that you know, using some form of technology to measure what is happening would be a great revelation, and it would move beyond just a hypothesis into the field of, you know, rational thinking.
Yeah, there's grav meters. H.D. Buoy in the 80s, funded by the EDF Foundation, he went and made a gravity snapshot of the Great Pyramid of Giza, and he calls it the densitogram. And, it's a basically colored, gravity imaging of the Great Pyramid of Giza, and it showed that it actually had stratifications of gravitational waves, which kind of falls into the theory, the understanding of focal points. So you'd have for the Great Pyramid of Giza, basically has three focal points. It has the King's Chamber is one focal point. The Queen's Chamber is another focal point. The Subterranean Chamber is a focal point. A lot of the pyramids in Egypt have subterranean or shallow or grade level chambers, but they're all pretty close to the focal points. If you were building a lens, this stuff is pretty close to optic physics. It's just a little, there's some slight differences. There's some major differences, but there's some major, connections between the two disciplines, but to get use everybody. But they do have focal points in them, and there's grav meters. I think they have my own experiments were done with weight cells in the moon, not necessarily 1,000 pounds I'll play with on weight cells, and I will track the angular location of the moon as it comes up right over the horizon. And it basically, once it just about gets in view, it starts lowering the gravity weight of 1,000 pounds. It'll lower it by 40 or 50 pounds before it even comes up over the horizon. So that's my own observations with my own primitive, equipment that I had. But
okay.
There is evidence out there. Gravity, it's a very difficult, energy to basically measure. I mean, to have the Goetje satellites measuring, did a gravity snapshot on the planet Earth. But, and we'll take what they got. They're thousands of miles apart. They shoot a laser beam to each other, and then they just go around the Earth, and, in a tight sequenced band, they just keep going around and around and around until they make up a gravity snapshot. But the problem is they're not taking into consideration of where the moon is when they're taking these readings. And we end up with a nice little pretty colored map of, gravitational anomalies and what's high and what's low, but it's not accurate because they're not, considering where the moon is, because the moon is flexing the gravitational field all the time on Earth. That being said, to have a true gravitational reading of the Earth, it would take you 18 and a half years, to repeat. So you would do one reading in a day, and then you would have to come back and do the other reading 18 and a half years later, because that is the length of the moon cycle where the moon is in the exact same position around the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very difficult to get a good scientific understanding of what has high gravitational fields on Earth and what doesn't. But we'll take what they're given. I mean, it's still something.
Have you found there's similarities between the pyramids? I have to I have to wonder, the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan, that whole complex, I should just say the pyramid complex, is very, very unique. And I was reminded of an author who posted a photograph of an aerial shot of the Pyramid of the Serpent, Plum Serpent, and how the smaller pyramids or platforms around it were all connected by an underground or a surface feature that made it look like a semiconductor board, so that maybe energy was traveling in through the pyramid and then distributed out to these smaller platforms that had things placed on them. Some people think there might be ships that were placed on them. That was a form of electromagnetic fields that were powering things. But I mean, comparing the Giza Plateau and the Giza Pyramid to pyramids at in Mexico, Guatemala, some of these monstrous pyramids, is there one thing that you've noticed that kind of is a unique feature that they all contain?
I'm not following the question. I'm like.
Well, I mean, it's like the Giza Pyramid has this inner chamber.
Yes.
It has rooms, the king's room and the queen's room, and then there's
chambers,
ascending.
Yep.
But the pyramids in Mexico, I don't think they've scanned them except for the pyramid, the serpent pyramid, which is at Teotihuacan, and it seems
right.
to have all its workings underneath the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that's kind of like makes all of them unique to be able to carry out these tectonic plate displacements or whatever?
No, again, it's a size. I understand what you're saying. Yeah. It's a size issue. Like, you know, the Chichen Itza, the Serpent Pyramid is not a very large pyramid. So it's definitely for local use. And like I said, it could wherever there's a gravitational vortex or condensing of the gravitational field, you're going to have magnetism. So the jury's still out on that, whether or not they were tapping into it for local power. Like I said earlier, you could, you know, put a huge coil, copper coil with, you know, iron, you know, wrapped around iron, and get, you know, if you can get electrons flowing, you could tap it for electricity. And who knows? They might have had some kind of, you know, like a waterways between, you know, the two or all these other particular pyramids or structures and other geoglyphs and created something. I don't really know. You know, I couldn't really tell you too much. I mean, I know, all I know is what I've been able to prove and measure and see is that they definitely work off the moon's gravitational force. So it's entirely possible that, you know, they've tapped into it for other uses. I mean,
okay. Have you come up with a solid, workable theory that could be replicated? And I ask that because maybe in the near future, we're going to start using and reintroducing pyramids on the planet. I mean, if it becomes known that they are doing what you're saying they're doing, affecting the tectonic plates in a positive manner, maybe we're going to have to build some more pyramids to
rebuild them.
Keep things functioning well.
Right. Well, the evidence is, I've often told people when I get into some debates, I said, you know, you're arguing against my theory with no evidence, but I have a theory that actually presents physical evidence. Like, you know, it's a physical evidence. I mean, you know, how many alignments do you need to see before you say, okay, it's doing this? Or, you know, or you see the high tides, you know, with the moon, you see the operations, you know, with the gravitational field with the moon. But, yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of what I'm presenting really is just the physical evidence. And, you know, I have formulas. I have some formulas and that have been checked out by mathematicians. They're balanced, but, of course, my theory has to be correct for them to be correct. But, again, I'm putting forth, physical evidence, observable evidence that shows that this is actually what's going on with a lot of these pyramids. And, again, it's a size issue. You know, the large ones for magma control, the small, medium ones are for land, raising land mass and local water control. You were keeping your aquifers full. So if you had a place like, you know, California, for instance, has a big drought issue and, you know, the rain comes down, it hits the ground, it goes into the aquifers, and the aquifers and ground tables are so low that they just drain off. But if you were, building pyramids in strategically placed locations, you could maybe control a lot of that groundwater around that particular pyramid,
Mm-hmm.
So I think rebuilding the pyramids that, if I was in Indonesia or, Malaysia or whatever, because they have a lot of volcanic activity in that part of the world, I would be, calling up Mexico saying, hey, when are you guys going to rebuild the, Pyramid of the Sun complex, because we want to open up, a hot spot and try to dump some of this magma pressure that's wreaking havoc over here in this side of the world. So
can you choose two pyramids that are well known and describe the effects on the opposite side of the world? Give us an idea of what's going on.
We have there's a bunch of them. I mean, we got the Giza. The one that's actually working, the only one that's working, is the pyramids in the Nile Valley line up with the Giza, Hawaii, not Giza, the Hawaiian hotspot. Sorry, getting a little confused here. And then you have the Shen pyramids line up with the extinct volcano in Bermuda. You have that newly discovered pyramid that is underwater in the Azores that lines up with the Tamu Massive, which is the largest volcano on the planet. And, you had Ledante and El Tigre that line up with the Nicobar and Andaman Islands. So, these pyramids are dormant. Now, I don't know everything. I'm just looking at the observable evidence. And, these pyramids, I would say, the two big ones would be Pyramid of the Sun in Mexico and Sri Lanka, which is Mount Sugeria. Mount Sugeria has a magma plug in it, and it's like an elongated skull magma plug. But they have like these giant claws on the steps leading up to the opening of the volcano, the magma plug, and they're just out of place, out of time. They're on scale with the claws of the Great Sphinx. They're not lion paws. I think they're bird claws. So there's like these little snippets of, information or lost history. Now, the volcanoes do have a play in, the global warming situation that we're in right now, because they release sulfur and aerosol, which are light reflecting. They're, they're cooling down the planet. So there is some use for, the natural volcanoes. And Mount Kailash lines up with the Yellowstone Super Caldera. That's the big one. And again, there's multiple purposes. This is one of the purposes I didn't discuss earlier. This would be a fourth purpose. I mean, these things are set up as thermostats. So if the planet gets too hot, it's going to shut itself down. And this is the, divine design by the planet builders, God, light beings, whoever you want to, believe it came in and did all this work. And then there's Mount Kailash is in Tibet, and there's a replica of Mount Kailash, a carved stone temple in India, and it's been They say it's like some kind of a religious monument or what have you, but if you look at it, it screams of a you know, a Mayan calendar type of you know, ornamental structure that has the same features as Mount Kailash. So, but so what I'm saying is basically, if the planet gets hot enough and the glaciers still recede up in the Himalayas, you get more of a lensing mechanism going on mountains up there, and it will you know, lower the gravitational field and allow that super caldera to erupt. And basically, when that erupts, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be a a direct shutdown of the planet. A lot of the global functions, conveyor belts, sunlight, and a bunch of other things. It's going to cool the planet down, but it's going to protect the planet from overheating. You know, if you have there's a inherent design of protecting the Earth and going into the next ice age, which is a normal weather pattern on the planet. I'd like to go into the ice age nice and slowly myself. Over a bunch of lifetimes, just take a we'll slowly migrate south to the equator, or north. Well, depends on where you are. If you're in the southern hemisphere, you migrate north. If you're in the northern hemisphere, you migrate south. You can do it over, a couple of thousand years.
Exactly.
Easy trek.
There's an inherent genius to these pyramid builders that we just don't know about. And your theory is very probable, given that there's an alignment, potential alignment with these volcanoes.
Here's another thing. It's like, I don't mean to cut you off, but I just want to put this in. After I looked at the mechanics, the gravitational mechanics between volcanoes and pyramids, I said, well, what else is going on? Is there something else natural in the world that's aligning? But what I came to find out is that mountains line up with mountains, like the Himalayas line up with the Rocky Mountains, the Sierra Nevadas, and the Appalachians. I mean, that's just one alignment. And then I said, okay, so you got mountains lining up with mountains, 180 degrees opposed to each other, same approximate latitude. Then back out even further, and I see the continents aligning up with continents, 180 degrees opposed to each other on the same approximate latitude. Like India and Mexico, they're both like a teardrop, like an upside-down triangle or a teardrop type of shape to them.
Right.
They're both on the approximate same latitude and on the 180 degrees opposed to each other latitude-wise, going back to the ladder rung. So, again, it's not just pyramids and volcanoes. It's mountains lining up with mountains, continents lining up with continents. I mean, you can go to Antarctica, where you have the pyramids up there, or down there, rather, where, honed into, geometrical shape mass to condense the gravity wave, and you have, volcanoes 180 degrees away on the same continent, in Antarctica. So there's a correlation between that and this. And yeah, basically the planet, like I tell everybody, is has been cut up like a jeweler cuts a diamond stone. It's been carved up to balance the gravitational field to give us, to manipulate magma, create stability. Another one of my discoveries was the continent of Antarctica underneath the ice is shaped like a hexagon. So I got into that theory, and that basically was set up on purpose to lock in magnetic north to true north, so you don't have a pole swap. Because that the flow of subatomic particles going into Antarctica versus Arctica, you have a blockage because of that lensing operation in Antarctica. So you slow down the flow to singularity, and that basically controls your magnetic field on the planet. It does move, migrate, to Russia or back to Canada over thousands of years. But the last geniuses that set this planet up locked it in with the adjustments of landmass with pyramid technology. So
wow.
So there's no pole swap coming. Not that I could see. It's been designed. The last design, but I think this is where we're at. We got to get mainstream on board, start looking at this. You know, get a couple of 100 scientists at the university level and start really jumping into these obvious theories. Examples, physical proof, and steps forward. You know.
So my last question to you, John, as we're getting close to the end of our program here, is what do you predict is the outcome of this discovery that you've made? Do you have anything that you can maybe give us a hint as to what you see the future of?
I think gravity is one of the last things to be harnessed in our little society. It's already been harnessed previously, but we haven't caught up to the actual workings of it. There's a lot of red tape, dogma, you name it, that is preventing this from coming forward. But the truth always prevails, going to come out, and I think the pyramid heyday is right around the corner. I think you're going to see a rise up from a grassroots level around the world, saying let's rebuild these pyramids for the future, because it is all about controlling your environment, having control over magma currents and temperatures. I feel that is in the future. If we can get by the a lot of the egos out there, I think it'll lead the world into world peace, because there'll be a universal job project, that
mm-hmm.
everybody has a stake in, and they'll cut back on a lot of the a lot of the nonsense that's between countries. So
you're predicting a level of consciousness that rises, that becomes more enamored with pyramid technology, maybe studying ancient pyramids, but more so some of the understanding of how pyramids work on gravity to kind of revolutionize how we work with nature, is what you're saying. It's
right,
cool.
Right. We balance the planet and, for all life on the planet.
Right.
Getting back to a more harmonious existence on the planet. So I think
mm-hmm.
Minds of get into trouble. So if there's a focal point for the human consciousness, and that is rebuilding pyramids for a better tomorrow, I think that mm-hmm. would really energize a lot of cultures out there to focus on getting these things back in operation again.
Right. The book is Pyramid Gravity Force. You can get it on Amazon. John's had it up there for a while. My guest has been John Shaughnessy, and really interesting subject. John, I hope to see some more work from you in the near future, because the first book, Pyramid Gravity Force, is just a taste of your work, and you've described some other things that would be interesting to have in a book too. So hope you can continue your work.
I have another book on the moon that's coming out. It's another lost, part of human history. And there's a lot more going on about that. So I should have that out hopefully at the end of the summer,
Fantastic. Hey, thanks for being on the show. Really, really enjoyed the material.
Appreciate you having me on, Cliff. It's been really great. Thanks for thanks everybody for listening too.
Well, let's stay in touch.
All right, man.
Thanks.
Have a good day.
That's John Shaughnessy, The Power of Pyramids. The book is Pyramid Gravity Force, and you can get that on Amazon. Fascinating idea. The minds behind pyramid technology in working with, it's a bigger picture. I mean, up to this point, we've talked about pyramids, inner workings, and maybe how they produced energy, for local, energy distribution to power machines and things. But here's an idea of pyramids actually correcting Earth types of volcanic displacement. Wow, pretty interesting stuff. Well, that's it for today's show. We'll look forward to seeing you next week on Earth Ancients. Have a great day.